It's showing 9 o'clock on my screen, so let us begin. Just a couple things before we get right into it. Some clarifications of last class. I had said that the book Makor Baruch, Volume 4, I thought the entire book was on the Nitziv, and I checked, and at least ostensibly, I was correct. The whole book is devoted to him. But if you know anything about Reb Baruch Epstein, it's I mean, everything is used for all sorts of tangents, maybe sort of like these classes. I mean, he goes off on wild and interesting tangents. Second point is I forgot to mention something, which I'm not sure how I forgot to. I was talking about the city of Nevardik and how the Aruch HaShulchan was succeeded as rabbi there by Reb Nachum Krakovsky. And I spoke about the Musar dispute. What I forgot to mention, and I even spoke about the Rabbi of Tavrig, Rabbi Borstein, and what I forgot to mention was that actually before Rabbi Nachum Krakowski was chosen, Rabbi Borstein was the pick of the community leaders to be rabbi in Nevardik, which is a strange thing, you might ask, because wasn't this the same Rabbi Borstein who had been condemned by the community leaders for attacking the Musar students? And that is true. And the reason Rabbi Borstein, by the way, never took up a position is because the head of the Nevardikers, Rabbi Yoizel, was able to get people to oppose it. But it seems that in 1897 is when he attacked them, and Rabbi Aruch HaShulchan dies in 1908, so it's more than 10 years later, so I guess things had calmed down enough. And finally, one other point. I raised the interesting question, and we had a little bit of a discussion about this note, what happens, you know, if someone condemns you, if a great Torah scholar condemns someone as a heretic, does that person then still need to respect in those sorts of matters? And someone pointed out something very interesting that I do think it's interesting, so I just want to share it with you for a minute, that we have a situation now, if you know, in Israel, and it's been going on for a few years now, with a big dispute in the yeshiva world, the Lithuanian yeshiva world, between the more extreme element, the followers of the late Rabbi Shmuel Auerbach, and I guess you would say the mainstream elements. And the leader of the mainstream elements, that is mainstream in the Haredi world, is Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, the son of the Stipler, and he said some unbelievably bad things about the leaders and the followers of the extremists. They have to be thrown out of their positions at yeshivas. And it's led to a split. There's new schools, new shuls. But when Rabbi Shmuel Auerbach was alive, and he was a great Torah scholar, the son of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, but he really became very extreme. It was very ironic. They were all talking about who really represents Rav Shach's tradition. And no one thought to wonder why Rav Shmuel Auerbach should be interested in representing Rav Shach. Why shouldn't he be interested in representing his own father? But in any event, Rav Chaim Kanievsky called him unbelievably terrible things. He called him a Zaken Mamre, which, you know, rebellious elder. I'm sure most people listening know what the penalty for rebellious elder is. He called him basically a nothing, a nobody, etc. But someone told me that there's a very interesting phenomenon in the yeshiva world because Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky is regarded as like the leader, and he's even very well respected, even from the other side. So I have a whole book attacking Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky's people, and they're very careful not to attack Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky. They simply say things like he's too old, he doesn't know what's going on, he's being taken advantage of. But even though they're the ones that he's calling, he says you can't even count him in a minion, that sort of stuff. And it's hard to know how much you take this seriously, but I can show you some of the unbelievably harsh stuff that's been said about him. I don't think anything is this harsh has been said since the days of the Misnagdim against the Hasidim. I mean, complete delegitimization of them and their leaders. And yet, I was told by the person who emailed me that in the Haredi world, the unwritten rule is that Rav Chaim Kanievsky and others can attack the other side, but you, as a layperson, even if you're a student of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, you can't say anything, which is interesting, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky never said that the masses can't attack the other side. On the contrary, he's given numerous statements, in which you see that his point is that everyone should think what he's saying and completely attack these people and treat them with no respect. And yet, I was told by this person that if you're, let's say, in a Haredi yeshiva, even one completely aligned with Rav Chaim Kanievsky, if you were to say what Rav Chaim Kanievsky says about the rabbinic leaders of this party, that would be regarded as improper. And I just thought I'd share it with you. It's interesting because I'm not sure why it would be improper. If Rav Chaim Kanievsky says that Rav Shmuel Auerbach is a Zaken Mamre, then why can't I say that? He's telling us this because he wants us to know that. In fact, we're coming up to Purim. He said about eights, this party eights, he said that just like in the Purim story, they all should be hung from the tree, like Haman. I mean, this is the extent of it. So it's almost like in the Haredi world, this has become a dispute that the masses are not supposed to get involved in. There have been other cases like that as well, but this I think we haven't seen this in a while. Okay. Let's return now to Rabbi Epstein, Yechiel Michiel Epstein, and we're going to begin with his great work, the Aruch HaShulchan. Let me get rid of this picture now. I have a couple of pictures I'm going to show you, by the way, as we go through the class. That's what he's known for, of course. If he never published his work, the Aruch HaShulchan, he might be remembered by people like me, but he won't be remembered in the rest of the world. Then, if you ask people who don't know that much about the Aruch HaShulchan, but at least know a little bit, he has a great reputation, which is a deserved reputation as a great mekil, they call it, someone who's lenient generally in halacha. He's not always. In fact, I have one case. I found one case where he's more stringent than the Mishnah Berurah. He even quotes the Mishnah Berurah and rejects him. But in generally, he's known as a lenient authority, and also one who tries, and we're going to see some examples of this, tries to justify communal practice, even when communal practice, from a pure textual standpoint, halachically, is problematic. And there's lots of examples of this where, as I said, we're going to see some of them. I can't spend, six classes. We could spend, if we wanted to, six classes just dealing with the Aruch HaShulchan, but I'll give you some of the most famous decisions which had real repercussions, and then I'll give you some maybe you don't know, which also show the same tendency. In fact, Chaim Soloveitchik, in his classic article, the article that gave everyone the word mimetic, but he was really the first one in the scholarly literature to call attention to this tendency of the Aruch HaShulchan versus the Mishnah Berurah. So I'll get back to that. But we even have oral stories, for example, of the Aruch HaShulchan going through the town on Yom Kippur, Erev Yom Kippur, and finding people who were sick to tell them that they have to eat. The same sort of stories we've heard about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, this work, the Aruch HaShulchan, which has been printed many times, here's my copy, you can see, obviously a reprint, a number of volumes. A number of the volumes appeared, I think it's four, if I'm not mistaken, or five, in the lifetime of Rabbi Yechiel Michiel Epstein. And the first volume, unusually perhaps, to appear was on Choshen Mishpat, on the laws, the monetary laws. And on the title page, it actually is from the original. Mine is the reprint, so it doesn't have the original title page, but the original title page says it was published in 1884. But it actually seems to have appeared really 2 years later. In other words, the title page was printed, and then it was actually not published until 2 years later. And the fact that it's on Choshen Mishpat is itself significant because Choshen Mishpat, unlike, for example, in the Sephardic world, we're going to Morocco this summer. Anyone can join us. If you look at the responsa of the Moroccan rabbis, and they wrote, in terms of practical halacha, an enormous amount. The sections dealing with Choshen Mishpat are very large. In fact, sometimes the sections dealing with Choshen Mishpat are larger than the other sections because everyone still had to go to the Beit Din, the Jewish court, and all monetary disputes were settled. However, in Eastern Europe, first of all, you had many Jews who were not observant anymore, and even among the observant Jews, there was a tendency, if you could avoid it, not to go to the courts. Strange when you think about religious people, but we have the same tendency today. If you look even the disputes between the Hasidic rebbes, when they have their great disputes, they always end up going to the secular court, and they'll tell you because they, and this is the reason I think, because they couldn't, well, they, let me take that back. They say they can't find a court which will be impartial, by which they mean they can't find a court which will be partial to them. But I mean, I say this a little bit cynically, perhaps, but I think it's the same thing because if they're by saying impartial in their mind, they mean impartial, but subconsciously they don't want it to be opposed to them, so they really want it to be partial. In any event, Choshen Mishpat began to drop off, and the Beis Din, of course, was a voluntary thing, and more people stopped using it. And I mean, it continues to this day. My father's on with us now. He could tell you the story when in the Catskills about 20 years ago, there was a bit of a fender bender. And he wanted to, rather than going through insurance, take it to court or anything, he wanted to go to a Beis Din, and the guy refused. And when he called up the rabbi of this, not a bungalow colony, the settlements, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, he said, he told my father that the guy, he just can't get him to go to the Beis Din. He won't do it. So unfortunately, that's often the case. And you had much less in the way of writings on Choshen Mishpat. So that's why it's significant. Now, the work, if you look carefully at the Aruch HaShulchan, you find something really interesting. That although it's set up in the order of the Rambam, the Mishnah, I mean, sorry, it's set up in the order of the Shulchan Aruch, that is the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, Yoredeya, Evan Ezra, Choshen Mishpat. Then, of course, there's the fifth section. That's what I was saying. But that's the joke, or the real comment of the Chazon Ish, that the fifth order, I guess, intuition that you find sometimes rabbis and even scholars who know the four orders of the Shulchan Aruch, but they don't know basic manners. They don't know basic common sense. I mean, so that's the so-called the fifth order of the Shulchan Aruch. But he doesn't begin with Orach Chaim like you'd expect, like you'd assume. Instead, he begins with Choshen Mishpat, the monetary section. And although it's in the order of the Shulchan Aruch, yet if you look carefully, it's really based to a large extent on the Rambam. Sometimes he cites the Rambam word for word. The Aruch HaShulchan is actually a very good commentary on the Rambam as well. And in the introduction of Choshen Mishpat, he gives a number of principles by which he's going to be guided by. And principle number 10 is that the most basic source for him is the Rambam. Now, it's true that there are certain areas he deals with which there's no laws in the Shulchan Aruch, but most of them that's not the case. And yet he still uses the Rambam to a large extent. Why does he need a code anyway? Why write a new code? I think one of the claims I'll make at the end is that, we're gonna have to agree that the Aruch HaShulchan really was a failure in the sense that it never became accepted as a code for the Jewish people as a whole. Where so much so that today it's not even regarded in much the yeshiva world, and I'll show you the evidence of this, as really a work that can stand on its own independently. Something you would not have expected. If you went back 100 years ago, let's say to 1908, you would assume that it, not the Mishnah Berurah, would be the dominant work. But in any event, it failed in becoming a code. And I think one of the reasons perhaps is that by the time you get to the late 19th, the early 20th century, there is no more room for codes like we used to. The Shulchan Aruch is too dominant. He can't be replaced. So in order for your halachic work to be accepted, it has to be written as a commentary. That is, it has to be written at least ostensibly on the Shulchan Aruch. Because look, if the Aruch HaShulchan then becomes accepted as the code for Ashkenazic Jewry or for Lithuanian Jewry, then what about Rav Moshe Isserles? He really is pushed aside. And that really is the tradition. You have the codes in the Rishonim, and then you have the later codes, the early Acharonim. But then you get to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and that really pushes aside all codes, even codes written at the same time, like the Levush. And no other codes really are able to achieve any real acceptance. So the Aruch HaShulchan was himself going against the grain. Since the times of the Shulchan Aruch until the Aruch HaShulchan, we have lots of commentaries. But how many codes do we really have? We have handbooks. I would call the Aruch HaShulchan, I would call the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and the Chai Adam is really handbooks, but we don't have full-fledged codes. But he tells us in the introduction that since the time of the Shulchan Aruch, that is the Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe Isserles, there have been many, many books of Achronim, the same story they always give, that there's been many more discussions and much has been written, and it's time to once again bring it all together. Now, I'm speaking about codes, you could actually challenge what I'm saying, and you'd be correct, perhaps, at least in the Sephardic world, because Rav Avad Yosef's son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, wrote a code called the Yalkut Yosef, and that, to a large extent, has become the modern code in the Sephardic world. Throughout the Aruch HaShulchan, I mean, in Choshen Mishpat, you see, though he's not just bringing down what is mentioned by the earlier sources, he gives his own ideas. And just randomly, not long ago, I found something that, which I think is interesting. I'll share it with you. As far as I know, there's no source for this. Just an independent thing dealing with the matter of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We know that the sages say that's not to be taken literally. And if you look in, he has a section, Chova b'chavero, injure your neighbor. It's in Siman 420, number 7. He says that the Torah's ways are darachei noam, ways of pleasantness. And then he says, though, but even from the chush, one sense, you can know it's that when it says an eye for an eye, it can't be literal. Why not? Well, I mean, the Talmud already gives the reason. Let's say you have your eye is better than the other person's eye, and you knock out his eye, and then if he knock out your eye, it's not even, it's not equivalent. So we have examples like that, but he gives a completely different reason. He says that if you knock out someone's eye, okay, it's a terrible thing you did, and there should be equivalency. Your eye should be knocked out. He says, but the fact that now you know. It's not like you just did it on, and once you did it just during a fight, let's say. But now you know that your eye is going to be taken out. And this is going to bring a lot of pachad, he says, fear and difficulty, tsar, of the future, knowing what's going to happen. And that's very difficult. And there, now you see it's not even. Because the pain and the fear and the worry of you know what's going to come, it's like they speak out to people on death row, that's a lot worse than you not knocking out this other person's eye, the feta pitom, just in a moment. And therefore it's, so therefore you can't have, there's no equivalence. And since the Torah believes in equivalence, and when you tell someone, well, your sentence, your eye is going to be knocked out, it's not going to be equivalent because there's all the mental stress. Therefore he says, you have to know that it's not literal. And then he asks in number 8, okay, well then why did the Torah say explicitly? Eye for an eye is monetary. And he says that this is the Torah's way. The Torah is written in such a way so that we don't rely on the Torah by itself. In other words, the Torah is not an independent work. I think I said a couple years ago when someone thought it was a heretical statement, but it's not at all. I said traditional Judaism is not based on the Torah, Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's based on the Torah together with the oral Torah. So it's based on both of them together. So you can't say that Judaism is based on the Torah, the five books of Moses. It's based on the five books of Moses as read through the. Someone got very upset when I said that, but fine. So it's a heretical statement. What can I tell you? It's true. So here's the Torah, Judaism is not based on the Torah Shebichsav, the five books of Moses. It's based on the five books of Moses through as read through the eyes of Chazal. We're not Karaites or Sadducees. And he says that's the reason why that the Torah precisely at certain times is not written in accordance with the way we understand it, so that it's necessary to have it together with its oral tradition. He says so that we would need nitzarich to have the Torah Sheba'al Peh. And then he gives an example that he says, what about the laws of the Etrog? He says, why doesn't the Torah say take an etrog? Instead, it says pre-Eitz Hadar. So a nice, fruit from a nice tree. Or perhaps I think some people want to say a nice fruit from the tree, but whatever, it doesn't matter. So instead of those three words, he says they could have had one word. They could have had, I'll get to all the comments later, it could have had etrog. Why doesn't the Torah do that? And the answer is this is done purposely. So that you don't assume that it's enough just to have the Torah, the written Torah, that you also need the oral Torah. And then he goes on to say that the Torah Sheba'al Peh gives the Ruach Chaim, a spirit of life, in the Torah, and no one can question it, and et cetera, et cetera. He says everything is clear through our tradition, and no one has ever had any doubt. It's interesting when you say about Etro, because a book came out last year. It's actually from a YU person, a YU Musmach. The book is, I don't know if any of you've seen this book, Etrog, How a Chinese Fruit Became a Jewish Symbol. Now, well, that's the whole argument of the book, showing that the etrog as we have it comes much later than biblical times. It comes from Asia and was only brought to the land of Israel much later. I'm not sure how much before Second Temple times, he says, but it was only later cultivated. So now, if you're going to ask a question, well, what does that do for the tradition and everything? Well, I guess you'd have to ask Rabbi David Master. He'll tell you it's not true. He'll tell you that it isn't the tradition going back and that it's a rabbinic understanding of it. But that's not what the Aruch HaShulchan says, and that's not what the Rambam would have thought. But I don't know. I mean, if you can prove that the etrog doesn't go all the way back and was brought in later, then I mean, you could read Rabbi Glasner's Dor Ravi very well with this sort of thing. But this, I just find interesting that this is a YU rabbi who wrote this book. And I only mention it because that's the example of the unquestioned Masorah that the Aruch HaShulchan gives. The Aruch HaShulchan, in addition to giving you the laws, also deals with criticisms of the Rambam and all sorts of other matters. They are found in the Rashi script. If you look on the page of the Aruch HaShulchan, you have the text, and not on every page, but on a lot of pages. Well, I don't need to find the page for you. You can just look at it. And at the end of sections, he'll have Rashi script. And in there, he deals with other matters which are really not essential for the law, but more side matters. It's interesting that in Choshen Mishpat, as well as other places, he includes laws that are not really relevant today. He includes the laws of the Sanhedrin. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, there's no such thing as the laws of the Sanhedrin. And this is not, he has a whole other work we'll speak about called the future Shulchan Aruch, Shulchan Aruch HaAtid, and Shulchan Aruch of the Messianic days. But this is in the Shulchan Aruch, the Aruch HaShulchan we have, the laws of the Sanhedrin. He has the laws of Smicha, the laws of real smicha, not our smicha today. He has the laws of ego arufa. If the dead person, you find a dead person, how, with the different towns you go, who's responsible. He has the laws of Ari Miklat, the laws of the city you go to. This is, if there's an unintentional killing, this is something that's not going to apply to Messianic days. So what's that doing? And we understand if it's in the Rambam, the Mishnah Torah, because the Mishnah Torah includes all sorts of things which are not relevant today. And yet this is in the Aruch HaShulchan as well, and not the future Aruch HaShulchan, but the Aruch HaShulchan that everyone has on their shelf. I find it fascinating, and he doesn't really explain why he does that, other than, I mean, the assumption is he's following the Rambam. But and okay, so then the Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, because the Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid deals with agricultural laws, all those things. Those are not included in the four orders of the Shulchan Aruch. But if he's going to do the four orders of the Shulchan Aruch and he's going to deal with Choshen Mishpat, monetary laws, then you have to also deal with things, and monetary laws when you injure people, and injure people you might kill them. That means then you have to deal then with the laws of the city of refuge, even though that has nothing to do with contemporary times, because the work, as I said, is really very much based on the Mishnah Torah. A number of you listening now have your own copies of the Aruch HaShulchan, and some of you might even have the new edition. There's this new publisher that publishes wonderful editions called Oz V'Hadar. They're really very much on the right in their religious politics, but they happen to publish wonderful editions of all the Sfarim they do. And they printed an edition around 10 years ago of the Aruch HaShulchan together with the rulings of the Mishnah Berurah. Nothing could be more clear about the failure of the Aruch HaShulchan and its falling, really, in the last 50 years even, from its place of significance, that today it's thought appropriate, proper, and even necessary that you can publish an Aruch HaShulchan and you can learn from the Aruch HaShulchan. But the idea is, when you read the Aruch HaShulchan, it's a work you study to fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah. But when you want to know what the actual law is, That's the Mishnah Berurah. And that's what you have to do. So therefore, you publish a book of the Aruch HaShulchan, but you let everyone know on the spot when we don't follow the Aruch HaShulchan. So first of all, that's a sign of the times. And we're going to talk later. We'll talk about, though, the views of the Aruch HaShulchan versus the Mishnah Berurah of people like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Henkin. But I'm talking about now in the 21st century. But in addition to showing the sense of the times, when you think about it for a minute, this is unbelievably disrespectful. It's disrespectful to the Aruch HaShulchan. You're saying that the Aruch HaShulchan is not able to stand on its own as a halachic work? Yehuda Hertz, Eitam Henkin, who wrote so much about the Aruch HaShulchan, and all of this is in the new book that appeared, he wrote a review in 2007 of this edition, and he calls it Laag LaRosh. He calls it like when you go in a cemetery, let's say, and let's say you drag your tzitzis on the ground, it's considered you're mocking the people who can't observe it anymore. And so he sees this as a mocking of the Aruch HaShulchan. He says no one would dream of putting out a work of the halachic rulings of Rav Vad Yosef and at the bottom say, well, what this is what Mordechai Eliyahu holds, because they're two separate approaches. And he sees, and I know Rabbi Dov Lior came out and said how disrespectful this is. And as I said, if you think about it, it is unbelievably disrespectful on the one hand. But on the other hand, if it's really the case that today we're in an era when the Aruch HaShulchan does not have any independent authority as a posek, which I don't accept, and there's still many today who do not accept that, but if that is the situation we're in, then it does make sense. Just like no one today would assume you could pick up a Mishnah Torah and read it and think you decide halacha based on the Mishnah Torah, so too no one could pick up an Aruch HaShulchan and decide that. But this wasn't the case even when I was young in yeshiva. I'll talk about that a little more towards the end of our classes. In terms of the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, since the Aruch HaShulchan is older, and he dies earlier, I think it's in 1908, and Mishnah Berurah lives much longer, a lot of people assume that the Mishnah Berurah is later. But from a halachic standpoint, the Aruch HaShulchan is actually later. What do I mean by that? The Aruch HaShulchan, Mishnah Berurah doesn't quote the Aruch HaShulchan. The Mishnah Berurah is written earlier, I guess. It is written earlier. I don't know if every single one of the volumes, but the Aruch HaShulchan quotes him at least 30 times. So the Aruch HaShulchan, from a halachic standpoint, is regarded as the Batrai, the later work. He sees the Mishnah Berurah and he responds to it. He doesn't only respond to it, sometimes he rejects him, especially to defend the Jewish people. Here's an example, which I think is well known. There's the halacha about peeling on Shabbos. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, they tell you that there's a problem peeling, let's say, onions, I guess it would be apple, anything, unless you're going to eat it immediately, because that violates the prohibition of borer. And the Mishnah Berurah says that, you know, this is a problem, that people do this, and, you know, they'll peel it now and they'll eat it later. The Aruch HaShulchan doesn't see the problem at all. And incidentally, although he criticizes the Mishnah Berurah, as I'll mention, he actually does not accept halacha the Ramah. The Aruch HaShulchan is able to, at least he felt he was able, to reject a ruling in the Shulchan Aruch, in Rav Moshe Isserles. And someone has said that this is quoted by Rabbi Yehuda Herzlhaken, and that's really the reason, not what I'm going to say, but this is the reason why the Mishnah Berurah was accepted, not the Aruch HaShulchan, is because we've reached the point where we cannot have figures rejecting the Shulchan Aruch. And the Aruch HaShulchan was still of the stature that he felt that at times he could reject the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah doesn't reject the Shulchan Aruch, and that's why Rabbi Henkin quotes this person as saying the Aruch HaShulchan was never able to achieve acceptance. But in any event, so the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't see this as borer, because what does borer mean? You know, borer is there's a combination or a mixture, and you remove the bad. That is borer. However, what are you doing when you're peeling? It's like if there's a blockage or something's in front of it, you're just removing the wall, I guess you could say, to get to it. And he says, and this is in the little note, the little Rashi script, He says that this is the practice of the women is to do this in the morning on Shabbos, and they could use this in for Shoshudas. And then he says, Uval Mishnah Brura Hirishal Zen, the author of the Mishnah Brura screamed about this. And therefore, he says, I'm going out now to justify what the people are doing, that what they're doing is accordance with the halakha. Of course, the Mishnah Brura isn't just, it's not his own opinion. He's saying what the Ramah says. But nevertheless, the Aruch HaShulchan, the people are doing this, and they're not eating it immediately. And he's saying that what they're doing is fine. And that's a trend we see in the Aruch HaShulchan of justifying the practices of the community. Many people have noted that the Mishnah Berurah was, he wasn't a communal rabbi. He was not the rabbi of Rotten. He's sort of living in this reified world of the yeshiva. And therefore, he's not dealing with the actual live people and their various problems. So he doesn't feel the need to justify what they're doing. He's writing a book of what they should be doing, where the Aruch HaShulchan, who's actually a pulpit rabbi, a communal rabbi, he's much more involved with the community. And the same trends we see people like Ramosha Feinstein, Rav Henkin, who are dealing with the people, they tended toward the Aruch HaShulchan. And today, halacha is not decided by communal rabbis at all. There's no posek of any authority who's a communal rabbi who deals with the people. They're all Rosh Yeshiva. And in my opinion, that's what's led to the ever-increasing chumras, because whereas people like even Ramosha Feinstein and Rav Henkin, there was a dialectic, because not everything they said people would listen to, and they have to deal with lay people who are not entirely ready to follow what they say. But if you're in B'nai Brak at a yeshiva, whatever you tell the students, they'll do. So you can reach new levels never before imagined of halachic acceptance. Another reason, oh, getting back to the point I said, Sir Yehuda Ritzel Henkin says that it was pointed out to him that the reason people accepted the Mishnah Berurah because he would not dispute with the Shulchan Aruch, the Magen Avraham, anything like that. And why didn't he dispute with them? Rabbi Henkin quotes him as saying, because of his humility. And the world prefers to paskin, to decide like the humble people. And the proof for this is he says the Talmud in Tractate Erevin 13b says, why was Beit Hillel worthy of having the halacha decided like them, not Beit Shammai? And it says because they were more modest and humble, and all the commentaries want to know what one thing has to do with the other, why the fact that they're humble. But that's what the Gemara says, and that's where Henkin mentions the quotes the this person is saying. He also notes, and this is true, that Rabbi Henkin represent Rabbi Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan represents the minhag of Lithuania, whereas in many cases the Mishnah Berurah represents the minhag of Poland. We've spoken before. We'll have to do classes on the Chafetz Chaim, but the influence of the Mishnah Berurah is big, and it's even bigger. It's growing. It's continuously growing. Soon it's going to be Purim. The fact that we repeat Zecher Zecher is because of the Mishnah Berurah. Without the Mishnah Berurah, we would not be saying it. It's because of the influence of the Mishnah Berurah. Yes, it goes back. It's older than the Mishnah Berurah. You already have supposedly a tradition, maybe going back to the Gra, but it wasn't done. This is really due to the influence of the Mishnah Berurah. The fact that anyone says Yiskadel instead of Yiskadal, no one before the Mishnah Berurah ever said Yiskadel. There's no such thing. There's no sitter that has it. There's no, so you have a maskil who comes up, well, quasi, I shouldn't say a maskil, a grammarian who comes up who says it should be this way, and then some people latch onto it, and the Mishnah Berurah latches onto it. But no one in history ever said that. There's no one in medieval times ever saying Yiskadel. So the fact that people today say it, it is very, very common, in yeshivas in particularly, that shows you the significance of the Mishnah Berurah, and I can give many examples of this. Now, as I said, and we just saw it right here with the issue of Shabbos, and there's loads of issues, a common tendency trend of the Aruch HaShulchan is to defend community practice. Limud schut is the technical term, trying justifying what the people are doing. Now, all great rabbis have done that at times, because you don't want to conclude, if you don't have to, that the community is doing something wrong. Every rabbi does that. However, it's just a matter of limits. The Aruch HaShulchan almost does it like as a rule. You can almost expect him to do it, so he doesn't do it. It's surprising. The Chasam Sofer says that anyone who questions a minhag, a practice, he says, Tzarech b'dika acharav. You have to question him. Because obviously, if the community is doing something, well, there must be some validity. But yet the Chasam Sofer also has practices where he says they're entirely incorrect. So there's no real rules here. But the tendency in the Aruch HaShulchan is to defend practices of long standing that people have been doing. In fact, many of the so-called chumras we have today are really not chumras. They're simply a rejection of practices that were done, but they're not invented out of thin air. They're actually what the Shulchan Aruch says to do. So people are, and what the Mishnah Berurah says to do. But we look at them as chumra because people in the past didn't do that. So often people say, well, because people didn't know anything. They didn't know what they were doing. But that's not really the case. Because almost all of these practices were defended by people at the Aruch HaShulchan or other rabbis, whether they were defended, like this because they felt they had no choice. But the fact is, these were the practices. It had, as Soloveitchik points out, it had not been a Holocaust. Had we not changed, the situation and gone from a mimetic to a textual system, we still would be following the old practices. Like today, and I believe what Soloveitchik says is 100% correct. If you want to know what to do, you go to the books to see what to do. If you're living in Vilna in the year 1920 and you want to know like what's the proper thing to do, you don't go to any books. You see what they do in shul. You ask your father. You ask the rabbi. And the rabbi's going to tell you what the minhag is. That's the way it was. So it's not surprising, therefore, that there was an organization called Eidah. It was a short-lived organization. I don't even know if it lived 10 years. It was the revolt, I guess you could say, of the liberal Orthodox. It wasn't against the Haredim. What do the liberal Orthodox have to do with the Haredim? It was the revolt of the liberal Orthodox against the move, what they saw as the move to the right in Yeshiva University. I spoke a little bit about that last week. I spoke about the black hats and everything. When YCT first started, they took out these ads. And they said in the ad something like creating modern Orthodox rabbis, and the picture in the ad, on top of the text, creating modern Orthodox rabbis, was a picture of a kippah sruga, a knitted kippah, showing you that our people wear a kippah sruga. I guess with my kippah, I guess I wouldn't qualify. But Eidah was formed. I was actually at I spoke at one of the conferences, and I was there. It was really interesting to see, be there, because, and this was point was pointed out by Alan Brill in one of his essays, it really wasn't being pushed by rabbis. It was being pushed by lay people. You had many lay people in the modern Orthodox world, communal leaders, professors, big shots, who used to have a say, who used to, give talks, who used to have influence. But with the turn to the right, the move to the Rosh Yeshiva, all authority was put into the hands of the Rosh Yeshiva. And most pulpit rabbis went along with it. So Eidah was pulpit rabbis, the liberal and even smaller pulpit rabbis. And it was journalists, it was all these people. And it was their way, as Brill says, and I think he's correct, of trying to regain some authority in the community. And I mean, the conferences were a little boring, I think, because I mean, how many times can you talk about saving a non-Jew on Shabbos? I mean, it just a lot of, and then I felt it was a bit contrived. I mean, Mincha. I remember one of the conferences, Mincha. So of course we have to daven Mincha, but they have a whole chazan there with chazonos and the singing, and I'm thinking like, I mean, this is Mincha on Sunday afternoon. Maybe I'm just too much of a litvak. I want to do Mincha, get it done with, and get back to the learning of Torah or something in there. So it was all, but and they had, but all these sessions, and some of them were quite fascinating. Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, for instance, has an unbelievable session. I remember it very well about is it okay for us to use great poskim whose morality or moral values, I should say, are so different than us? Can we still use them as halachic authorities? And he dealt with Rav Moshe Sternbach, whose views on certain matters are really way out, even immoral, I think, in some areas. And yet, or Menashe Klein, if you want to put up an Erev, he's the one to go to. All these sessions were taped. Now, what became of the tapes? I have no idea. If someone knows, it would be a wonderful exercise to put them online so they're there for posterity. Fortunately, the Eidah Journal is still up and is in charge. In fact, I arranged, it still has its website. I don't know who's in charge, who's there, but I arranged a number of years ago because one day, the ADA website is just going to disappear because the organization doesn't exist anymore. And the journals with all the important articles, including a number of articles that I wrote, are just going to be gone. So I arranged for YCT on their website. They also have copies of all that. So at least it's there. In any event, the founder, I should say the founder, the leader of ADAP was Rabbi Saul Berman. And when they first began, of course, they had all these great ideas, great projects, and everything. His great project was to have an English translation of the Aruch HaShulchan. There already is an English translation of the Mishnah Berurah. In fact, there are two English translations of the Mishnah Berurah. But from the standpoint of Rabbi Berman and Ada, what we need is an English translation of the Aruch HaShulchan because that will affirm community practice versus the Mishnah Berurah, which is trying to, uproot community practice in the name of a textualism. I don't even think they finished one siman of the translation of the Aruch HaShulchan, but the fact that that was the great idea shows you something. At the beginning of, I'll get to all the comments in about 10 minutes. At the beginning of the Aruch HaShulchan, Choshen Mishpat, you have an essay. The essay, here's the essay on the left. It's called, well, for just the first page of it, it's 2 pages. The essay is called Kvod Melech. That is the honor of the king. And in the context of, and then following that, there's his introduction, talking about, why he wrote it, etc. But this goes before it. And incidentally, when this essay was reprinted, when the Aruch HaShulchan was reprinted by the Aruch HaShulchan's daughter in Warsaw in 1911, and Warsaw is still Russian territory. 1911, the essay was taken out. So there could be some reprints that don't have it. Mine has it, and it's an important work. This is, if you know rabbinic works, you know that often works published in particularly in Russia, on the first, on the second page, will have a short comment there that, every time I mention Akum, the non-Jews, it doesn't refer to the non-Jews we live in who worship God and are good people, but it refers to those pagans in places like India and China. And the anti-Semites always said that when the rabbis said things like that, they didn't mean it. And that, I mean, that was a common thing that was said. And I said last week, I'm going to say something, and people might say I'm anti-Semitic. So I'll say the same thing that when those comments were made on the second page, you're not supposed to take them literally and seriously. That is, they didn't really mean that. They had to say that because of the censor. So I see that if someone's going to get offended and saying now that I sound like an anti-Semite, I'm saying that when the rabbi said it, they didn't mean it. What can I tell you? Even the anti-Semite can get it right once in a while. But then there's no question that that's the case. So then, when you get to the Aruch HaShulchan, you look on the inner page, you expect to find something, but you don't have those, that, the one sentence or two sentences. Instead, you find an entire essay called Kvod Melech. So let me tell you about this essay, because this essay, as well as other passages in the Aruch HaShulchan, have become subject to a great dispute, a dispute that, was made its way all the way to the Israeli Supreme Court. Became a dispute and dealt with by Menachem Eilon, how to read the Aruch HaShulchan. It's a very relevant issue today because of the laws of Mesira, of informing. And so let me explain a little bit what's going on here. The whole this essay, first of all, written in the Tsarist period, is meant to respond. He doesn't deal here. He deals in the book itself. He doesn't deal here with the idea that the various laws and things I mentioned don't apply to contemporary non-Jews, just to the people in India. That really annoys me though when I hear this because I've been to India, and India is they're great lovers of Israel, many of them, and they're great allies of Israel, and we shouldn't be knocking India. And those who watch the news, remember what I ended last class with? I told you about those people in America who don't know about the two congresspeople. If you've been watching the news today, she put her foot in the mouth again. Omar from Minnesota. I mean, it's unbelievable. She's only been in office now a month, and she can't help herself. But in any event, and that's from the so-called the monotheists. So I'm not so into trashing the Indians or the Chinese or any of them. In any event, this essay, the point of the essay is to respond to all sorts of accusations against the Jewish people, and is designed to portray them as loyal citizens. Now, this essay, let me read you some sections of it. For those who are interested, you can find the whole essay translated into English in this little volume that I mentioned last week called The Boldness of an Halachist, Rabbi Yechiel, an analysis of the writings of Rabbi Yechiel Mechel Levi Epstein. And as I pointed out already, you cannot say the boldness of an Halachist. Proper English is the boldness of a Halachist. But in any event, as I said, don't judge a book by a cover, don't judge a book by the title page. He makes a number of worthwhile comments in the book, and he has a whole translation. But let me read you just some of the things he says, and I think after I read it to you, you won't have any doubt that I am correct, that what the Aruch HaShulchan is saying is with an eye to the censor. Remember, the censor, every book had to be written with approval of the censor, including the Aruch HaShulchan. And we'll see an example later of where the censor made him change something in the book. Who were these censors? These censors were apostate Jews who could read Hebrew, or even Jews who were not apostates, but were so disillusioned with the Jewish world that for money were willing to act as censors. I guess maybe there were some who figured that they had good intentions, that they were trying to civilize, you know, their benighted rabbinic brethren. In any event, let me read you some of what he says in this whole essay, which is designed to defend the Jewish people. And okay, he begins by saying that the sages of the Talmud and the Mishnah, they loved the kings and their princes. And they gave them, you know, real fear. And even when we had a kingdom in the land of Israel, we were told to, you know, we have to, you know, to treat the rulers of the nations properly. Jeremiah said we have to treat Babylonian king properly, et cetera, et cetera. So don't think that we're not loyal. Don't think that we don't show respect for the king. And he says, if this is what our earlier sages said, that we have to respect the leaders, the kings, if they said it in a time when there were no, it was basically a free-for-all, there was no mishpatim kavuim, no set laws to defend people, but rather the king would do whatever the king wanted to do, and we still had to show respect and follow the laws. Says, Allah kama bakama, all the more so that today, when there are rules and laws, etc., and the king just can't take your property if he wants, it says we are obligated and le'ahov Adonenu hakera. We are obligated to love the czar and just have fear, be fearful before him. And therefore, in the entirety of Israel, he means in the in Russia, we pray b'lev tahor with a pure heart every Shabbos and Yom Tov before Hashem. Al Shalom Adonenu Akera v'Ishto v'Zaro v'Chol Mishpachto. We pray for the welfare of our Lord, the Tsar and the Tsarina and the Tsarevich and the whole family, because we love the Tsar, because he's our ruler. Okay, now I think anyone who knows anything about Jewish history knows that like the, you know, the prayer in Fiddler on the Roof, you know, keep the Tsar, you know, far away from us. Obviously, they knew they had to respect the Tsar, and they, and when the Aruch HaShulchan says that we respect the leadership, that is true. They knew they had to respect. That's part of what it means to live in the diaspora. However, to say that they love the Tsar, I mean, this is the Tsar that's keeping the Jews in the Pale of Settlement. This is the Tsar, the family of the Tsar, that not long before you had the whole Cantonist laws. This is the czarist regime. We're talking 1884 here, not long after pogroms. This is the czarist regime, which institutionalizes anti-Semitism, which is in lockstep with the Russian Orthodox Church. Everyone knows, what the czars meant for the Jews. To say that they love the czar, respect, yes, but to love, because you can respect even if you don't love, because that's your role in life. And then he goes on. So I don't think anyone can seriously claim that this is an actual reflection of Jewish sentiment or of Rabbi Chiya Michel Epstein's sentiment either. And then he says, "And what's the proof of this?" He goes on. Because for all the years that we are living in the Russian Mamlachat Rusya and the Russian Ha'adira and the Great Russian Kingdom, you will not find even one person from all the thousands and thousands of Jews who observe the Torah, who's at all involved in Mirida, in revolution and uprising, God forbid. On the contrary, it's the opposite, that we always masarnu nafshatenu Russia. We have, extended ourselves because of the love of the czars and their and for all and what they did, Kaidua, because everyone who knows history knows what Jews did in the year Tafresh Ayinbet is 90, in 1812, in the French War in 1831 during the revolt, and Alexander the First and Nicholas the First, they were thankful to the Jews that the Jews, didn't rise up in rebellion and they remained loyal. I mean, the Jews are smart not to rise up in rebellion. They just remain quiet and let's see where the wind is going. And it is true, I think, that of those Jews who, remember, he says, Hashomrim dat Torateinu, who are observant, they're not involved in any acts of rebellion. It isn't true to say, however, that Jews were not involved in acts of rebellion. In 1881, Tsar Alexander is assassinated, and there was some, I guess, minor, but there was Jewish involvement in that. And Jews, as the decades go on, Jews become very much involved in revolutionary activities. But that doesn't contradict what the Aruch HaShulchan says, because the Aruch HaShulchan says those Jews who are Torah observant, and I've never heard a case of a Shomer Shabbos Jew, a Torah observant Jew who was at all involved in revolutionary activities. Well, I take that back. There were some. I mean, Bernard Revel, actually. But that's later. In the period of the Aruch HaShulchan, I don't know any. But later on, Bernard Revel was, I don't know how involved, but he was, as a youth, a bit of a revolutionary. And there were a few in the yeshivas, of course, there were plenty of people, but that's later. At this early period, I don't know of anyone. Later on, the yeshivas in the 20th century, early 20th century, in 1905, the yeshivas become centers of revolutionary type activity. That's really the reason why the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed, by the way. Now we know it wasn't because of secular studies. That was always the story, the legend, because the Netziv closed it because of secular studies. That wasn't that. That was the way the Russian government closed the yeshiva. But anyone who it always bothered me. There are other yeshivas. Why Volozhin? Why didn't they try to make secular studies in Slobodka or Mir? But we now know because of the Russian documents that were released and Stamford, this time in the Hebrew and the English volume, the second edition of the Hebrew and the English volume, we have the documents. It's only now with the fall of the communism that we know why, that there was problems with the students were sort of in an active rebellion. They didn't want Chaim Berlin becoming the Rosh Yeshiva, and it's the Tsarist government does not want young people rebelling against religious leaders, getting all these ideas in their head that they can determine things. So they were getting reports of the internal fights and disputes going on at the yeshiva, which was considered the greatest yeshiva, and they thought it was important to shut that down. You can't have a situation where young people are rebelling against the leadership because then that's going to spread. Next thing you know, they'll be rebelling against the local duke, against the czar, etc. And that's always been an issue in modern times in Russia to stamp out all these revolutionary sentiments. But simply to issue an order that the yeshivas close, that's not very tactful. So what they did was They came up with a plan that the Nesi would have to close the yeshiva because basically they made the yeshiva secular studies all day. Maybe give him an hour of Torah studies the rest of the day, even more than New York State wanted. Like 10 hours a day of secular studies, whatever they want. They knew the Nesi would have to close the yeshiva. Okay, I see it's already 9:55. I'll take the comments now, but I have to go on in this document. And then we need to speak about, do we have examples of internal censorship? That is, Aruch HaShulchan censoring himself, even changing the halacha in the face of censorship in the actual text of the Aruch HaShulchan. And that's going to become an unbelievable dispute, which, as I said, a Supreme Court decision in Israel, Rabbi Nachman alone, rose and fell on this question: do you believe what the Aruch HaShulchan is telling you, or does it enter the actual text of the Aruch HaShulchan falsehoods with a wink that people are supposed to know? The problem is he doesn't wink. So how do you know if what he writes is false, as many say, or true? And that's what we'll pick up next class, and then we're going to move on more into various matters of the Aruch HaShulchan, various halachot, and all sorts of other things. So again, this is, I didn't even say, today's February 11th. This was the third class. Let me now get to some of the questions and comments. First, Moshe from Lakewood. There is a quote from Ratzvi Hirsch of Liska, who supposedly remarked to someone when asked if it was okay to disparage Rav Yirmiyahu Lev, who attacked him, quote, "The mitzvah of shofar is a great mitzvah, but it is fulfilled by one blowing and everyone else listening." In other words, if one rabbi attacks the other rabbi, that doesn't mean that you should join in. The interesting thing, though, that in this case, Rav Chaim Kanievsky never said don't join in, and this was published in Yatei Ne'aman. But that's a good story. Thank you for that. Moshe from Lakewood also says it's perhaps the dominant personality of the Chafetz Chaim which overshadowed him. I actually agree with this. I don't just think it was the dominant personality that overshadowed the Aruch HaShulchan. I think it was his reputation as a saint, as a saintly figure, that over time he became known as the great tzaddik, the saint, and that really was his reputation. He lived very long too. And because he was such a central figure, that brought along the Mishnah Berurah as well. Bill says, "I heard without proof that the Lavush outsold the Shulchan Aruch in Northern Europe until the beginning of the 18th century." I've never heard that, and I don't know. I find that hard to believe. But I can't say. You could look, I guess. I'll look. For next time about the printings. I mean, you can't always judge by that because you don't know how many printings there were, but I'll see. I mean, the Shulchan Aruch printed many times. I can't imagine that the Lavush even comes anywhere close. And the Shulchan Aruch by the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, is full of commentaries and discussions of it. No one's talking. At the end of the 18th century, no one's talking about the Lavush. So I can't imagine that even for a second that that was true. But I'll check on that maybe to the end of the 16th century. Okay. Did he give the name to the Aruch HaShulchan HaSid? Good question. I believe he did. I will check. I'm not up to it yet. I haven't prepared those talks yet. But we'll have it. I thought you were going to ask me why I'm ready to give the name. How to pronounce the name Aruch HaShulchan. I'll get to that next time anyway. Next time also. Moshe says, "I think it's significant to note that the Mishnah Berurah was a group effort, but the Aruch HaShulchan was compiled all by himself." Okay, I think what Moshe is alluding to here is that the son of the Mishnah Berurah claims that he was also involved with this. Is that what you mean? I mean, does that make it a group effort? Other than the son, who else was involved with it? And I don't know, why would that be significant? The information that the son of the Mishnah Berurah was involved with it is only known to us because of the biography that the son of the Mishnah Berurah writes, and he explains that's why there are certain contradictions. It makes sense, and I have no reason not to believe what the son of the Mishnah Berurah says, especially when other sons and son were around, and if you would say that it wasn't true, they could testify. Sons-in-law also were around, and they could testify it's not true. But it's interesting to note that some people don't accept that. There are people who reject that and say, despite what he says, It's not true, which again, if the son of the Mishnah Berurah says it, you have to assume it's true. And no one knew about that really. That I think has significance because we accept the Mishnah Berurah, we follow the Mishnah Berurah because Reish Lakish, our Kohen, says it. We don't accept the Mishnah Berurah because of the son. If the son put things in, that doesn't bind us. That's so it would have halachic significance also, I think. Bill says in Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's 30th day Hesped for Soloveitchik, he said what I heard directly from him in Shiur 53 years ago. In Yiddish, he says, we paskin like the Rishonim, and we you have to explain to me what kantaliert we deal with. How would you translate that with the Shulchan Aruch? I'm not sure what that means. So Bill's going to explain what kantaliert means. We control. Okay, with the Shulchan Aruch. I'm not sure because by the time of Aaron Lichtenstein, the Shulchan Aruch, it's not like it is today, but it's still pretty authoritative. Of course, coming from the Brisker tradition, Rav Chaim Brisker, as we know, did not feel bound to the Shulchan Aruch. Most famous example of this is Yom Kippur. Shulchan Aruch says if someone's ill, I mentioned like the Aruch HaShulchan, telling people to eat. The Shulchan Aruch says you have to eat a little bit, one tiny bit, every bit of time, pachos mikashir, less than the proper shear in the amount of time. The Rav Chaim and Brisker did not accept that. He thought that if someone's ill, they just eat regular. And there are other examples. Moshe says, is this also if it's peeled not directly right when you want to eat? No. If it's peeling and you, it's not. They say you can peel it, but you have to eat it immediately. But if you peel it and you don't eat it immediately, then they said it's borer, and that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says it's not. And the problem was that all the women Friday Shabbos morning would peel the stuff and they'd leave it for Shal Shabbos. Paul Shaviv, Side Kamat Neida. I tried hard to convince Neida to start day schools. It would have been decisive. By the way, there was an even shorter-lived successor, Porat. I think Paul, I think Porat, the extent of its existence, was an ad or two in the Jewish Week and one evening event where a few people gave talks, and I guess a website. That was the extent of it. But Eidah had a few conferences, and I was even hired by Eidah to. I'm going to be publishing something very soon. Don't want to give it away, but you'll find some of the stuff in there. But I was hired to write letters to various big rabbis in Israel to ask them a halacha question, which was important to Eidah. And there was money there. There was backing by some important machers. The conferences are very large, very well run. And Rabbi Berman was going around the country speaking, and it gave a sense of life in liberal orthodoxy. You could say that maybe it closed because of their success, but I don't think so. Moshe says Keira is an abbreviation for Kezar Yarum Hodo. Yes, and I mean, just to point it out, they would say the Caesar is the same name as Tsar. They all come from the same thing. So when you say the Keira, it's whenever you mention the ruler, you say Yarum Hodo, that he should be exalted. In fact, the second quote I read from the Aruch HaShulchan, from the introduction, he didn't even say the word. He said, he says that we have masarnu nafshotenu al avat kisrei Rusya. We have given our, we are moser nefesh for the czars. Moshe says the son-in-law was also involved. Which son-in-law? Okay, I'll just wait for Moshe then to say which son-in-law. You're saved by Zach's. Aaron HaCohen. Was Aaron HaCohen really involved? I didn't know that. Aaron HaCohen was the son-in-law. He wrote an important two-volume work on sacrifices. Today he's remembered more because he moves to Eretz Yisrael, and during the great dispute over Rav Kook, he comes out with a really sharp letter against the extremists and talking about how much respect his father had for his father-in-law had for Rav Kook. But I didn't know that. So first, I didn't know that, so you'll have to send me the information. Now, yeah. Double check it and send it to me. I had never heard that Rav Aaron Cohen, I think the name of the book is Avodas HaKarbonos, if I'm not mistaken. I had never heard that he was involved in the work also. Okay, thank you all very much. So we've covered three classes now. We'll meet class number four next week. Good night, everyone.